This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name, as always, is Alex Perney, and today we are very pleased to welcome on Brian King, founder and CEO of Lodas Markets, L-O-D-A-S Markets. And it's really kind of an interesting topic at hand because, you know, throughout the tenure of this podcast, and especially if y'all are familiar with what we do at Advanta IRA, of investing in strictly alternative assets, you'll know that there's, you know, really a lack of an open market for these types of assets. Now, granted, there's a very large spectrum of alternative assets. You know, While I don't agree with the fact that real estate is considered an alternative asset, it is from the construct of retirement plan investing, if you will. But there's not really an open market for these kind of assets, whether it's, you know, commercial real estate investing into limited partnerships, private stock investments, private REITs. All of these different kind of private assets can be a bit of a walled garden, if you will. Unless you kind of know the deal sponsor, the person raising capital, there really isn't a place like you have with the traditional stock markets to go on and say, hey, look, I'd like to buy this, or hey, maybe I'd like to sell something. There really isn't anyone creating a market or an ecosystem for that. And that's one reason that we wanted to have Lodas Markets on today, is that they've kind of, you know, branched into creating a solution for that. And I'm painting with way too broad of a brush and missing a bunch of points, at least in the initial intro to this. But again, to paint a little bit of a picture of what we're going to be talking about, that's certainly going to be the topic at hand. So Brian, thank you very much for being on with us today. If you wouldn't mind, give us a little bit of background about yourself, kind of how you grew professionally into the position that you're in today with Lodas, and then we'll kind of dive into the problems and what you're looking to aim to solve with this particular platform.
Perfect. Well, thank you again, Alex, for having me. It's great to be a part of your podcast. A little bit about me. I started as a financial advisor in the early part of my career, and then had a fantastic opportunity to kind of make a pivot in my career, where I started working for a startup stock exchange. Many people may know that stock exchange. It was BATS Global Markets, which was founded in the Kansas City metro area. And it grew to be the third largest exchange in the world. During my time there, I had the ability to move over to London and was the first person on the ground to start building BATS Europe. Today, that is the largest exchange in all of Europe. And then we were ultimately acquired by the Chicago Board of Options. And I used that kind of as an opportunity to leave and go to the New York Stock Exchange, where I was there for about 5 years, overseeing trading, market structures, and ETFs. So my background, again, having been in the exchange side of the world, the focus being so much of the time in making liquid things more liquid, speed of execution and depth of liquidity and that type of thing. Really what I saw is that the growth of the private markets, it was just expanding so much. You know, companies are staying private longer and more dollars are going into the private markets than are wanting to go into the listed markets. So with that, you know, I thought the next big aspect of my career is, hey, if I've built so many different marketplaces over my career, if I had the opportunity to now turn and pivot and create liquidity for things that are traditionally illiquid. And so that's exactly what we did when we set out to build Lodas Markets.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a very good point to make, is that there has been a rather large expansive growth for the private markets. You know, I've seen it just in the past 12 years that I've been doing what I have, and strictly in the alternative space. You know, back in 2011, 2012, it was the alternative markets were almost hyper-focused to the real estate realm. And since then, to your point about companies staying private longer, you know, you have a lot of these tech unicorns coming out and you're seeing multiples of billion-dollar valuations while they're still private. You know, the need for, you know, an IPO to really have that growth has been changed a little bit. There's so much more capital in the private sector that is driving these people to continue to raise capitals, have additional seed funds, have additional stock issuances on the private side of things. It's creating a problem in the market space. You know, there really isn't, again, to that walled garden, kind of unless you knew the person issuing it or saying, hey, like, how do I get into this stuff? There isn't a market out there for it. So let's kind of get into the beginning stages of when you developed this marketplace? What were kind of the core asset types? Was it, and again, this is, you know, private stock and private equities based, but what were kind of some of the markets? Was it strictly just based on the non-publicly traded REITs? Was it private stock issuances? What were kind of the cores that you focused on when you initially got started?
You know, when we first started, it was we looked specifically at registered funds. So these are funds that are filing K's and Q's with the SEC. And most of the time, those registered funds are going to be either REITs or BDCs. So they're not listed on exchange, but at the same time, they are kind of filing publicly so that people are able to have some level of transparency. And we started there for a couple of reasons. One, there's already a lot of transparency into these funds, kind of the mechanics, the financials, et cetera, distributions. So there's a lot of, because of the fact that they're filing with the SEC, there's a lot of that is made publicly available. Secondly, a lot of these funds are very, very large. The average fund on our marketplace that fits into those buckets is somewhere between $1 to $5 billion. And the vast majority of those assets were raised by retail investors. So they could be affluent, they could be super affluent, but they're still typically raised by individual investors. That was the area that we started again, because you typically know in those types of funds, while they in many cases aren't liquid at all, or there may be no liquidity opportunities, they're growing. If they've been alive for a longer period of time, the funds have been alive for a longer period of time, there's more sellers that are innately growing inside of that fund, right? So they're building up a queue of people who are looking to try to find an opportunity for a redemption.
Certainly. Now, just so my audience can understand, can you define what a BDC is?
Sure. A BDC is a business development corporation. Oftentimes, it's a debt-related fund that is funding a business, in most cases, private businesses, and that type of thing. So it's being able to, there's a lot of different ways that they could invest in it, but it's a lot more on the debt side of a business.
Okay, gotcha. So it'd be kind of like a private equity firm or group that specializes in debt issuances to other underlying companies. So kind of the umbrella, and they plug into different industries or maybe have a core focus, right?
That's right.
Okay. So with these types of assets, now, most of the time, these things, again, like you said, are going to be relatively illiquid, meaning that one, there's not a marketplace to sell it. With the publicly traded stock exchange, there's market makers out there that have quantities of bid to then in turn plug out. You know, there's always someone buying something. There's always someone selling something, but that doesn't obviously exist here. And being the problem that you're trying to solve. The other part of it, again, is the lack of liquidity. And some of these investments have restrictions in their covenants and actually subscribing to them that would make transference an issue. So were you only identifying companies that said, hey, you can sell this on a private market? Or did you have to broach these companies and say, hey, look, if we have a market for this and they are otherwise qualifying investors, would you have some type of exemption or allowance for the transference of these shares? Because I know that's a problem I run into. I'm working with a client right now with a private REIT that's a little bit of a nightmare, to put it mildly, let's just say. And again, that's some of the kind of the issues is just like transference and, you know, just kind of the paperwork involved in it. So what are some of the kind of back ends that you did to solve those types of issues?
Yeah, so for us, again, that was another reason why we started with the registered funds first, because most of the registered funds, they work with a transfer agent and in most cases don't have a transfer restriction. But as we moved down the line to more private related investments, they do have restrictions around transferring ownership. And so for the ones that don't have restrictions, technically we don't need to be working with the sponsor. We can trade it in an over-the-counter OTC method and be able to do that. And again, just to maybe take a quick step back, our process of being able to buy and sell is fully automated. So somebody could come in, they could set up an account in less than 5 minutes and be able to place their sell order for one of these funds. So that's actually something that we see happening on a very regular basis, new sellers coming in. We have a large number of buyers that are ready to interact with those people looking to sell. But on the private side, we definitely need to be working with the sponsor. On the registered side, we want to be working with the sponsor, but we don't need to be. On the private side, in most cases, we need to be working with the sponsor. So the sponsor says, hey, you know, we had this We have somebody who's looking for liquidity. Can you leverage this with your network of buyers and see if there's any interest out there amongst your audience?
Okay, yeah, it definitely makes sense. So in the traditional sense of a market, you don't necessarily have a market maker interaction with this. It's more of kind of a marketplace to where you have, let's say, the few sponsors, and let's say more on the registered side with the private REITs and the BDCs, where, okay, these are already kind of going through a more formalized stock exchange, if you will. There's a transfer agent. There is no inherent lockup or restrictive covenants in there. And basically someone says, hey, look, I can't sell this. There's no redemption for it. I have to be satisfied with the rate of returns or whatever is stated in the actual investment, but I otherwise like some liquidity. So they come on, you know, kind of list their asset on the platform, and then someone else will be like, oh, that looks interesting, I'll buy that. Is that, again, kind of the high level of how it worked, at least in the beginning?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So for us, again, one thing worth mentioning is that we are we're an ATS. So for those in your audience that may not know what an ATS is, an ATS is a lot like an exchange. We're registered with the SEC and function much like an exchange. The difference between an exchange and an ATS is that an exchange self-regulates. An ATS has to outsource their regulation to FINRA. So therefore, they're also a broker-dealer. So with that caveat aside, you mentioned, you know, there's not necessarily a market maker in the middle here. And to an extent, that's true. As of right now, we don't specifically have market makers. Our market is built so that we could have market makers, somebody that's sitting in between the buyer and the seller. They could go in and acquire a bunch of liquidity, then go and deliver a large position perhaps to a buyer that's maybe not wanting to sit there and pick up each individual piece as they go along. But certainly there's a lot of flexibility as to how our market can operate.
Now, that's interesting, you know, dealing in the very private space that I've dealt with for my career, you know, I never really kind of run too much into FINRA for the most part. SEC to an extent with making sure that PPMs and different types of private offerings comply to the securities law of, you know, 33 for their exemptions into the more formalized SEC regulations. But in this case, these are not, you know, again, some of them are a little bit hybrid, some of them, and we'll get into the more private stuff you've done, but explain a little bit about, you know, what it looks like in the regulatory space for FINRA to have some oversight with this. Kind of what are they looking for? And, you know, what's kind of the, you know, overall thought process of them being involved in this if it's not really publicly traded securities?
Yeah, so for anytime you have a security, and again, I think in most cases, everything that we're talking about by definition is a security, whether or not they have to file, you know, with the SEC or file with FINRA, you know, that's or even file with the states. You know, there's a lot of different exemptions that these assets have under various rules. And so they might not have to file with certain entities by those exemptions. But for us, because we are transacting in a security as an ATS, transacting in that security, they just need to make sure that we're doing proper disclosures, we're doing proper feedback as far as, you know, what's happening from an execution perspective, that we're doing our due diligence on who the buyers are, who the sellers are, that we're clearing and settling it in the right way, et cetera. So there's that level of oversight to make sure that we're not operating outside of our bounds, and that at the end of the day, the SEC's biggest objective is protecting the investors. That's their primary purpose, is protect investors. And so from that perspective, again, overseeing, having oversight over an ATS, that's what they're ultimately going to focus on, is making sure that we're looking after the end investors.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, good for people to understand kind of the regulatory, you know, atmosphere and ecosystem that you work in. But the interesting thing for the private side of things is there's such a big spectrum. You know, some of the stuff that we deal in has really no oversight from almost anyone. You know, think about, you know, a client wanting to issue private debt to different individuals through a retirement plan. Besides the client's interest in doing so, there's no one telling them they can't do that. And then obviously very highly regulated things such as, well, I don't know, pick your, all the way up to publicly traded securities. But again, the spectrum of what kind of oversight is on these, especially with new stuff, I always find interesting, just because when something is new, sometimes regulators don't know. It's like, well, this doesn't really fall in your bucket. That didn't fall in your bucket. So who looks over it? And, you know, I might get some flack for saying this, but I think regulatory oversight painted with a broad brush is typically a good thing. You know, when I think we see the reduction in oversight, you see the big overcorrections from the late 90s reduction in oversight. You have things like Enron and WorldCom that come out of that. So again, I think levels of oversight are good, and understanding kind of, especially with new stuff, where it comes in is interesting to me, maybe not to anyone else, but hey, I can learn something too, right? So, you know, coming from the perspective of, you know, you've kind of identified the need in the market. You start with the stuff that's kind of, again, adjacent to the publicly traded stuff that has a need for a market. I'm just trying to think of which question I want to ask next, because I got a couple here. Well, let's start again. Let's start at the beginning, and let's have an interest in finishing this up. So when it comes to identifying customer bases, so you identify a problem, right? Now, that's all well and good, but if you solve a problem that no one, you know, adopts the ecosystem and utilizes, you know, it's kind of a moot point. Great idea, but where does it go? So how do you kind of like, how did you go out and identify a customer base? Was it just basically outward facing marketing? Did you already have a large pool of business that you had, you know, just kind of immediately said, hey, here's what we have going on? And further to that, do those people have to be accredited? Are these just rank and file retailers? Is it kind of the whole spectrum that utilizes and adopts this, this ecosystem?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think for us, as we set out to start the very first thing that we did is we listed one fund. And I say listed, it's obviously not to be confused with public listing on an exchange, but we added one fund to our marketplace. You may or may not be familiar with a company called Phillips Edison. It was a grocery anchored shopping center REIT that ultimately did list on exchange. So what we did is we knew that there was an opportunity there. We knew that there was a lot of shareholders. We knew the CEO of Phillips Edison. And so we had those initial early conversations saying, hey, we could help with some pre-IPO liquidity. We know you're getting ready to list on NASDAQ, but we also know there's a bunch of people that are anxiously waiting to hit a sell button day one. If we can relieve some of that seller pressure before you actually list this thing, it could be really beneficial for the overall fund. And we've actually seen that play out pretty substantially. I mean, it was a great story of a REIT listing on an exchange. I can't say that we take all the credit for it. At the end of the day, Phillips Edison is a great fund and has performed really well post IPO. But again, for us, a big focus is saying, hey, if we can remove some of that initial seller pressure, it's fantastic. So there was a communication point that said to their shareholders saying, hey, if you're looking to have an exit, here's an opportunity to do it. We have a natural buying audience. And I will say the vast majority of our seller or of our buyer base is institutional in nature. But at a minimum, you do have to at least be an accredited investor to be a buyer on our marketplace. Now, you don't have to be accredited to own a REIT, a publicly registered REIT. But the reason why we do that is because in most cases, those REITs, they have to be suitable investments for people who are not accredited. If you're accredited, then you don't have to worry about suitability requirements. And so that takes some of that regulatory pressure off of us to make sure that the buyer is suitable. So we have institutional or at least at a minimum accredited investors that are buying. We have retail investors in many cases that are the sellers. But we also have, we built another level to our marketplace that allows a financial advisor to come in on behalf of those individual investors to be able to set up accounts. And we call that advisor view. The advisor can set everything up for the client. And then we also have something above that called firm view, where the parent firm of that advisor can have complete oversight over the whole process.
Yeah, and it makes sense for the accreditation just because of all the, you know, again, the suitability issues that come with all these different types of things. You don't actually have to worry about that. And I'm assuming, you know, if you probably wanted to build it out, there might be a path forward. But, you know, building out those APIs and everything like that for doing the non-accredited stuff would be cumbersome, probably, to say the least. But from the aspect of a seller, do you need to be, if it was a retail person, do they need to be accredited to sell on the marketplace? It's just the buy.
No. Right. They don't need to be accredited to sell. But what's interesting, so if you do want to be a buyer on our marketplace, we'll ask you an extra little subset of questions as you're going through your onboarding process. If you say, no, I'm just looking to sell, we eliminate the need to answer any of those questions, and the buy button actually disappears off of the marketplace. So until you go back in and attest that you are an accredited investor, et cetera, that buy button won't appear back on the marketplace.
Okay. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Now, from the perspective of, and I definitely kind of had a trajectory of the next question I wanted to ask, but you saying a few of these things pops into my head. Well, let's go to the next one. So let's talk about a little bit of the evolution. So we have, again, the very adjacent to publicly traded stuff. Now, that how long did you kind of run just in that kind of sector with those types of assets being listed? How long, one, how long has Lotus been around? And two, how long did you kind of focus on that particular market?
Yeah, so I'll take a quick step back just to give a little bit of the evolution of our history. So we're still a very young company. In 2021, we started building the technology at the same time. In parallel, we were going through our regulatory process. The regulatory process to become the broker-dealer ATS, and we also happen to be a transfer agent. Maybe we can get into the reasoning why we're a transfer agent in a second. But we went through those regulatory processes in 21. We officially launched in December of 21 with that first fund that I mentioned, of Phillips Edison. And so for the first, let's say, year throughout 2022, we planted a lot of seeds. And most of what we were doing was in the registered fund space. In 2023, we really started to be able to harvest it. And we started to see this hockey stick of growth, which has been fantastic over the last, like I said, call it 10 months. And then, but also simultaneous to that, we started listing some private deals. So we have some private energy funds, we have some private real estate funds. And so we've really kind of widened the net of where it fits in the structure of the actual process.
Okay, gotcha. So it's just kind of a natural progression, although albeit a very condensed timeline. Some of these things that you're saying, I would imagine, would just as easily happen quickly as well as, something that takes years and years to kind of mature. But it's interesting to see how this is kind of, ramped up in that fashion, because, I don't really know much about the marketplace for these things. Well, one, there's not much of one, and two, it's just kind of hard for me, at least, to wrap my head around the concept of it a bit, because I've dealt with this stuff for a decade plus, and it's always very restrictive on everything. I've seen people hold, private equities for 5, 10, there's been, I think there's a few clients of ours that we got, back about 20 years ago that still hold the same private equities in their retirement plans, which is great. I mean, obviously they're happy enough to still have it and the companies still exist, which is also great. They do exist for there to be an investment. But again, just interesting in looking from that. Now, is this what you're building out? Is it strictly just a secondary marketplace, or have you had any, or are you potentially going to look at people looking to raise capital saying, hey, we have new issuances of stuff that we'd like to list on this marketplace? So instead of buyer, holder to seller transactions, would it be maybe issuer to buyer transactions? Or is that something that you have currently, or maybe you're looking to in the future?
So a great question, and timely question, because I'll start by saying our core competency, the core problem we're trying to solve, is secondary liquidity in the alternative space. That being said, there are a couple of different sponsors that we're talking to right now. They have closed offerings, things that have been closed for many years. There's not really any liquidity available in those funds, but they're starting to roll out new funds. And if you're rolling out a new fund, you're trying to raise new capital, there's two things. A lot of times you're going to the distribution channels that you went to before when you were raising fund one. And in many cases, those people who are distributing it said, listen, until you solve the liquidity issue over here on fund one, we don't necessarily want to distribute fund two. Second thing is, obviously, a fund two, like, their biggest need right now is to raise capital, right? So to going back to your question, the short answer is yes, we do have the ability. We're approved to do primaries. We can do it. Core competency is secondaries. But we've created some pretty unique structures for some specific funds that say, hey, if we have shareholders that are in fund one, that want to have a liquidity event. But some of these people who want a liquidity event just want to be able to either A, roll into something new that maybe has a better distribution, has a better liquidity valve, or something along those lines. And so we actually have buyers in place that are sitting there buying up those shares for anybody who says, I want to sell fund one. And then we're giving permissions to anybody who wants to roll into the next fund. Let's say somebody had $100,000 in fund one. They want 50% liquidity and they want to roll 50% into a new fund. We can do that. We can actually structure that process that gives them that initial liquidity and roll into the next one. And then basically what happens is now that person who was able to buy up those shares, the buyer, institutional buyer that we have doing that, can actually then turn and take their shares and convert it in from fund one, convert it into fund two. So there's some really cool, unique strategies that we're working with various sponsors that are trying to solve, in some cases, multiple problems, and they're leveraging our platform to do it.
And I think in the best word I can come up with is maybe an unintended consequence, kind of as a negative connotation, but in this case it would be a positive, is that while you yourself don't have like a formalized market maker structure, it sounds to me like you have at least some of the institutional people, them seeing the value and saying, okay, well, if I can buy up, you know, a tranche of this, this looks like a good investment, and there's obviously people that are buying it, you know, I can buy it here, you know, at a certain valuation. And is there an ability for them to price point and make the spread? Or is it strictly a price point that's set by the issuer? How would that kind of work for these people, like you said, that are going in and buying up, you know, an issuance of shares, and whether or not they want to do that type of conversion factor, notwithstanding, you know, what does it look like from them? Because obviously they purchase, and if they're an institution to sell, how is price point pegged for these kind of transactions?
Yeah, so for most cases, I would say I don't think we've actually had a case where the sponsor is dictating what price it should execute at. In most cases, the sponsor wants nothing to do with where the execution is going to be on a secondary market. But many of these funds actually have are posting or publishing an NAV. Some private funds don't do that. So they're not showing what the real mark is on a monthly or daily basis. But I'll give another example of a situation probably most of your audience is familiar with, Blackstone's BREIT. So BREIT is the largest REIT, I think, that's ever existed. It's in an NAV REIT structure, which means they're providing liquidity on a monthly basis. And but about 12 months ago, they hit caps, right? Meaning that people who were asking for a redemption, they in most cases were being prorated, so they couldn't get their full redemption because there was too many people asking for it at one time. And there's a limit as to how much Blackstone is able to meet from a redemption perspective. So we looked at that as an opportunity to say, hey, we could list BREIT on our marketplace. So anybody who's looking to sell that can't get all of their money back, I think at this point, nobody has gotten all of their money back that even started 12 months ago, putting it into the queue. But they would have the ability to say, listen, I need my money now. They could actually sell it on our marketplace. There is a little bit of a spread. Right now, it's trading at around a 4 to 5% discount on our marketplace. So you're going to give up a little bit in spread. But some of these buyers that are sitting out there are saying, listen, I have a different time horizon than these people that are looking to sell now. I have an interest in holding this for a year or 5 years. But to your point of being able to kind of maybe create an ARB, they can ARB that spread, because once that redemption queue has cleaned out, they could actually put it into for sale into the into Blackstone's redemption queue and be able to get full price, full NAV price. So there are buyers that are stepping in there, they're seeing the opportunity and to an extent, again, functioning similar to a market maker, but you know, certainly not qualified as a specific market maker as one would think of in the equities world.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. I mean, granted, the velocity of this stuff doesn't really allow for like price trading and arbitrage, but from the point of saying, hey, you have, let's say, an undervalued or depressed value, and when it comes to this particular REIT, one, a few things are a little bit alarming, but two, yes, I mean, you know, it's not going to go anywhere appreciably. It's going to exist. It's a REIT. You know, you can have its problems. It can be a little rocky, but it owns real estate. It's not like an intellectual IP. There is, you know, shopping centers, houses, there is stuff underneath of it that is there, which is one of the beauties of real estate. It exists. It's tangible. I can touch it. But from that point, it again kind of creates new opportunities and markets within this that maybe, obviously you didn't ever really kind of see coming. One, I don't think we ever thought that this REIT would have a freeze on redemptions or anything like that. I remember reading that in Bloomberg and I was like, oh, well, that's interesting. Normally when their company pops up, it's maybe not the greatest headlines, but normally it's not like a redemption freeze on a REIT that they're managing. So that was, again, an interesting read. But I think that kind of opens up another question on what are some other interesting things that maybe you didn't kind of see as happening in the beginning of this? And I think that's a really good one on saying, hey, we have a redemption queue that's being prorated right now. So people need a liquidity event. Granted, they're going to be taking a little bit of a discount on what they're selling, but certainly there's some institutions or back end that's buying that. And the thought is that once this stabilizes, then they'll be able to redeem at face value. And maybe the spread is only 4 to 5%, but if they're looking for something very stable, it's not the worst return in the world. So what are some other things that have kind of cropped up or that you're seeing currently, or things that you kind of think are going to happen by the nature of where things are kind of pointed with the trading activity that's happening on the platform?
Yeah, so I think probably the biggest and maybe I would say even best surprise that I've had so far is that initially when we set this up, my thought was that the buyers were exclusively going to be institutional in nature. Like I thought that was the way that you solve the problem is having institutions. In some cases, institutions want institutional size discounts, and so you start to see wider spreads. But what has really evolved that I've been really excited about has been take the BREIT story one step further is that we have some financial advisors that are out there and they're on a month-to-month basis dollar cost averaging their clients into these funds, right? So the clients are every single month putting a couple $1,000, $10,000 into the fund. And so we have now seen a lot of financial advisors that are now the buyers on our marketplace. And they're like, listen, I was going to buy this thing at NAV. If I could buy this at a 3% discount or a 5% discount, I'm a hero to my clients. We're already buying it. And then we also, similarly, we have some funds that have performed really well. There's a fund, an energy fund that we work with, a renewable energy fund called Greenbacker. It has performed incredibly well. A lot of financial advisors have poured a lot of their clients' money into this fund. And then they look at it and say, wait a second, there's opportunities for me to buy more. This isn't raising any more capital. My clients, if they had the ability to kind of rewind the clock and buy more, they would have done it 100%. Or maybe that financial advisor says, this client has it, but this client of mine over here doesn't. And if they had the opportunity to buy it, they would. So when they start to see opportunities to buy more of something that they already like, they're willing to do it. But because of the fact we have so many people that are bidding to buy, it's compressed the spread, right? So when you have one buyer, they're saying, oh, I'll get it at a 15% discount. But when you have a bunch of buyers, all of a sudden you see that spread compress pretty dramatically. And I think that's been really exciting. But again, going back to it and saying that when you're looking at the who is the buyer, like that's great. To be able to see a change in that dynamic where it's not just institutional, you have, individuals competing with institutional buyers.
Yeah, and I think that's actually an interesting point that you make of saying, the nature of private investments is that there's, one, there's a finite amount of shares that are issued. And granted, there's a finite amount of shares of any company that's issued. But when you're talking about, a private equity, of any variety or something like that, the numbers are significantly smaller. You don't have hundreds of millions of outstanding common stock like you do of Microsoft or IBM. There might be, let's say, 300. Granted, the share price is much higher, or there might be, hundreds of thousands. But again, comparative analysis, be what it may, look at what your favorite stock on the New York Stock Exchange is. It is going to be a fraction, and maybe even a fraction of a percent as much of the volume. And especially when it comes to trading volume as well, it's even, it's statistically insignificant if you were to run the calculation on it, which again is interesting that there is enough of a market in this to create something that you've created. But to that point of saying, okay, we have people that have a very well-performing asset and they've stopped issuing shares. So how do you buy it? Well, you have to buy it on a secondary market, and creating an opportunity for people that said, hey, I wish I had more of this to buy more of it. Now, this is where kind of the simple laws of economics kind of come in. You know, you have very few people buying, more than a few people selling, the spread and discount's going to be bigger. But is the majority of things being sold on this marketplace, is it always typically at some form of a discount, or is it at a par value? What is typically kind of the pricing that you see most often? And is it basically just standard economics apply, or are there kind of some interesting things that you're seeing as far as how the pricing structure and the spread and discounts plays out?
Yeah, so I think that's a fair question. I would say the vast majority of the things that trade on our marketplace are at some level of a discount, right? But I don't think that's always going to be the case, and it hasn't always been the case on our marketplace, right? There's been some cases where there's been some product where somebody's like, I really want that. I'd be willing to buy it at face value because there's no shares available, right? I want it, so I'd take it at the current market value. But again, I think in most cases, to the point of what you were mentioning earlier, is that there just aren't as many shares issued. So you don't, that means your audience of interested buyers is typically going to be smaller. But I will say one quick caveat, though, is that when you look at the real estate market generally, and this will kind of go further the point of why we started with real estate related securities. We're not just real estate, but most, you know, I'd say 80% of what transacts on our marketplace today is real estate related. And it's because that when you look at the markets today, typically people invest in what they know. You know, so they'll buy stocks and bonds, they'll have a stock and bond portfolio. But if they had an interest, or like they had a real specific knowledge of art, they're buying art. But you typically don't find somebody who doesn't know art that invests in art. So everybody invests in what they know and real estate. Right? Almost everybody invests in real estate at some capacity, even if it's just owning your own home, right? Most people are investing in real estate. And so that creates a very, very wide breadth of people who have an interest in owning certain elements of real estate. And again, when you think about the addressable market, you're right that the individual funds might be smaller than a Microsoft. But at the same time, when you look at what the size of the real estate market is in the US, the private market space, there's all kinds of numbers of what people speculate on it, but the commercial real estate market, I think, is somewhere around $18 trillion, right? That's a massive addressable market, right? And so for us, being able to look at that and say, okay, that's the addressable market. I know when we first started to create this business, everybody that we talked to, I didn't have one person say, you shouldn't be doing this. Everybody was like, this is so needed, incredibly needed, especially during what's going on right now, keeping in mind that we were forming this company in the throes of COVID. And everybody's like thinking that real estate was going to be, you know, completely decimated. It didn't happen when they were thinking it, but there's some elements of real estate that are being highly, highly affected right now. The only negative feedback that we ever got from people is saying like, you know, but real estate, it's not supposed to be liquid. Like you're not, like you buy it and you're supposed to hold it for the long term, right? And so it's not innately, it's not supposed to be liquid. But one of the things that the feedback that I would kind of present is saying, well, you know, you mentioned Microsoft and IBM. Technically as a company, it's not liquid. It's only liquid because there's a secondary market, right? And so from the seat that we sit in, there really isn't anything that shouldn't have liquidity, have a liquidity feature. And from where we're sitting, the sponsor is probably not the best person to provide that liquidity, right? So for Blackstone to say that they're going to be the ones that are providing all of the liquidity to the people that are looking to redeem shares, sometimes that's going to cause you to do unnatural things, either sell an asset prematurely that you didn't want to sell, or two, go and have to raise money from University of California to be able to, you know, and give them a special promotional rate to be able to raise that capital so that you can then in turn take that capital and give it to shareholders in redemptions. Those aren't natural behaviors of a fund economic. So for us to be able to create a secondary market is definitely more natural, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, notwithstanding, again, the general sentiment, having your assets have some type of better marketability is probably a good thing in the long run. Granted, being able to buy real estate at the click of a button like you do with a publicly traded security, I don't really think is good generally, but again, to have that back end liquidity where it's not kind of the coal mining town where you buy it, you get your money, you buy it, you sell it back, you go to the company store, kind of like what's happening with BREIT. You invest into it, you get your money back out from them, and any liquidity interaction is strictly just with the issuer. I think again, having a more diverse market is going to be a healthier market, which is kind of what you're aiming to apply here. Now, from the perspective of, let's say, the investors that are looking to acquire more liquidity, or let's say from the seller side, when someone plugs into a market like this, is their ability is it kind of one of those things where they kind of self-list the asset that they have? Like, let's say, hey, I'm holding BREIT and I have a fill my order at X, good till filled kind of thing. How does it look like from like the integration standpoint of someone listing their asset on this platform? Again, like you said, they set price point. They set it too high, it's going to sell. They set it too low, they miss out on a bunch of money. So what does it look like from the actual consumer interface into this? How does that kind of run?
So for us, we took a very traditional market approach to it, in that, and again, I'm using kind of my background of building marketplaces in a traditional sense, and so wanted to be able to apply a traditional market to it. So the way that it works today, I would say there are limit orders, there are IOIs. You're never going to see a market order. So I don't think I have to do a whole lot of explaining there. But from an we also have IOIs. That's an indication of interest, and that's typically from the buyer's perspective. They're saying, "Hey, I have an interest in buying this particular fund at X price," and it just sits out there, right? And they have the ability to get notifications when sell orders come in, et cetera. The IOI itself is non-binding. Then you have on the other side, a seller has the ability to put in what's called an RFQ or a request for a quote. So in the traditional registered fund market that we have, in most cases, I think maybe even in all cases, we have active buyers for every fund that's listed on our marketplace, right? So, and what they're doing is all these different buyers are putting out IOIs, indications of interest that say, I'm interested in buying at X price. And in most cases, it's multiple millions of dollars deep. So they're going to say, I'm interested in buying at $10. Somebody else may say, I'm interested in buying at $9.50, but all of those are going to be displayed. So when a seller comes in, they actually see, we put all the data in front of them. So they know what the NAV is, they know what the best bids are. And so that helps them drive to see where the market is, right? So when a seller comes in, most cases, what they'll do is they'll put a sell order in for where the buy order sits. Now, if they don't like that buy order and they say, I want to name my own price, they can do that. They can put in a limit order. If, say, the best buyer was at $10 and they're like, I'd like to put it in for $10.15, they can put their limit order in at $10.15 to see if they can get somebody to come in. The IOIs are still going to get a notification that that order came in, and they'll make the decision whether or not they want to reach up to grab that or not. But in most cases, on the registered fund side, it's a buyer-driven market. The buyer is saying, this is where we believe the market is for this fund. On the private side, now you're talking even smaller funds, right? Some of these REITs are multi-billion dollar funds. On the private side, you're talking maybe 50 to a couple hundred million dollars in size. They could be bigger, but still, that's usually the range. So you don't necessarily always have a buyer that's sitting out there with an IOI waiting for a sell order to come in. But instead, that's where we have a seller has the ability to put an RFQ in so that it can send out a notification to the buyer network to say, hey, look to see if you want to be able to evaluate a price for this. And the seller could say what they're looking to get. But then it's a way of being able to communicate in a autonomous, like in a anonymous way, to each other to say, hey, we're trying to find the market, find the price.
Okay, cool. And so again, there can be like the request for like basically putting us on like, hey, here's what I'd like to probably here's how much my order is going to be. And again, that's kind of a lot to take in, but do you have ones where it's just like, fill at this price and it can automate to that point? Say, look, if someone can fill this for, $15.50 a share, it'll automatically just trigger, or is it again a little bit more is there inherently some back and forth in that, or is there any type of way to like just put like an automated fill order in and say, look, fill it at this. If it doesn't fill it, fill or kill is just there, or it doesn't fill.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we definitely have that capability as well. So they could come in, they could put a limit order to say, like, I'm looking to sell it. If I can get this, great. And somebody might come in and just grab it. If it's a good price for them, they understand it, they did the diligence on it, then absolutely. So I should also say on the private side, we do have like a data room. So if there's information that's private, again, in many cases, the sponsor, because it's private, they don't want the information of their fund being broadcast everywhere. So it's behind a firewall. In a data room so that the buyers can be able to go in and look at it, diligence it. But the only people who are going to get access to that data room is somebody who's already been pre-approved by the sponsor to look at it.
Okay. Yeah, and that makes sense. That was kind of my next question is that, sponsors in any form or fashion typically get pretty guarded about their PPMs, prospectuses, and all the back-end secret sauce that goes into them. I've been very lucky in my career to get to read hundreds of them, which most of my colleagues are like, one comes across their desk to process, and they're like, oh, another 80 pages. I'm like, that's cool stuff, man. Like, you get like a real like in-depth market analysis that's hyper-focused on exactly what they're doing. I'm like, that's just free information to, use it, look at it, apply it to your own life. It's really cool stuff. But that, again, that was kind of going to be kind of the follow-up to the end of this is saying, like, how does the information flow happen? Because a lot of the stuff is very sensitive information, and that certainly makes sense to that effect. Because someone could say, hey, like here's the redemptions, here's my the average pref being paid on these shares outstanding, but you want to know why and how that's happening. You're not just going to blindly go out there.
I would also add, though, quickly that I mentioned earlier that we're also a transfer agent. And the reason why we're a transfer agent is, in most cases, the sponsor doesn't want to be involved in the secondary transaction, right? They don't want to be associated with saying that this is the price that it should transact at. And so in the financial world, there's only two people that can update a cap table. Again, the cap table is the official list of who owns that particular investment. And the only two people that can update it is the sponsor and a transfer agent. So for us, we felt it was very important to be a transfer agent so that if a fund decides they want to list with us and we can become their transfer agent, again, many of these funds are managing their cap table on an Excel spreadsheet. So a gross analogy would say we're turning that Excel spreadsheet into a Google sheet. So now it's shareable, right? So we're both looking at the same thing. The sponsor can update it if they raise more capital. We can update it if we're changing the ownership from Mr. Jones to Mrs. Smith. And so we can actually change that within our walls to be able to do that. And that way it removes the need for the actual sponsor to be involved in the process at all. So we can do that secondary transaction kind of behind the scenes.
That's really awesome. I think that's definitely a good place to kind of bring this in for a landing. So if people are just interested in learning more about this, because I think we definitely gave a good scratch to the surface, but there's a lot more kind of in this column of interesting things that this really kind of applies to. So whether you're on the sponsoring deal side or whether you're an investor that has one of these kind of assets, how can they reach out and find more information regarding Lotus Markets?
Yeah, so first thing, they could follow us on our social media handles, which are all listed on our website, which is lotusmarkets.com, LodaSMarkets.com. And then they could also send an email to info@lotusmarkets.com, and somebody will be able to respond to them very quickly, just to kind of give, again, whatever their answer is. Even on our website, we have the ability to fill out, a questionnaire, submit questions or whatnot.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much, Brian. I really appreciate you being on with us today. As always, I hope everyone got some good information out of this. I know I certainly did. This has been the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast. My name is Alex Perney, and have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at AdvantaIRA.com and subscribe.